All right, I call this meeting of the House Labor and Commerce Committee to order at 5:19 p.m. on Wednesday, January 26th, 2022. Members present are Representatives Kaufman, McCarty, Nelson, Snyder, Co-Chair Fields, we've got Shragi, and myself, Chair Sponholz. I'm a little out of order there. Let the record reflect we do have a quorum to conduct business today. Thanks so much to our Secretary today, Leah Fraser, and our LIO moderator, Nate Williams. Reminder to members, announce yourself before speaking. For those that are listening online, we've got a couple of testifiers on the line today. And if you haven't already, this is a great time to silence your cell phones. We have two items on our agenda today. A third hearing and final action on House Bill 220 relating to a retirement option for public employees and teachers. A sixth hearing on House Bill 159. Actually, I think it might be a seventh hearing on the Consumer Data Privacy Act. We'll hear public testimony and hold the bill. Amendments for both House Bill 220 and HB 159 were due yesterday at 5 p.m., and no amendments were received so far. So to date, we're going to go ahead and move to House Bill 220 relating to creating a defined benefit option for public employees and teachers. We had a second hearing on this legislation last Wednesday when we took public testimony. Would the bill sponsor like to make any comments on the record?
Thank you, Chair Sponholz, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Grier Hopkins, representative for House District 4, Esther, Goldstream, Farmers Loop, Birchill, Steel Creek, and Downtown Fox. Thank you all for bringing the legislation back up for a hearing. As the chair said, it's the third hearing for the legislation. Talked to a number of you and worked out different questions and things like that. And, you know, as the chair said, it is an option. There's nothing retroactive about the bill. It is only going forward for individuals who became a member of TERS Tier 3 or PERS Tier 4 from 2006 on. The structure is set to be cost neutral for the state, so because the main reason is that they are currently putting in, what they are putting in for TERS and PERS Tier 3 and 4 would be the same amount of employer contribution that they are currently putting in, as well as not dealing with any new healthcare structure. The bill does a number of other little things, but that's the main structure of the bill that we are moving forward on to create a defined benefit option for people, should they so decide to switch from a DB to a defined contribution. Happy to answer any questions the committee might have, and thank you very much, Chair Funnels.
All right. Are there any questions for Rep. Hopkins? All right, Rep. Kaufman.
Through the chair to the bill sponsor, so the premise of this legislation is that there's a gap that was created, as I understand it, and that this legislation is to help close that gap in terms of retirement plans to assure that workers are made whole. Is that essentially the premise?
Representative Kaufman, through the chair, not quite that workers are made whole. If in the legislation, if a member of the PERS TERS system does want to switch over from a defined contribution to a defined benefit, there is language in the legislation that would allow them to cash out their 401k and purchase their time to be made whole. In that sense, we are working on a calculator for that, so we can look at what those numbers are and how what it would be. We'll be presenting that in the Finance Committee and the next Committee of Referral. In terms of the reason for the bill, the gap I would point to more so than making employees whole is the gap that we are seeing grow more and more in the retention and recruitment of our public employees, public safety, and educators in the state. In the November hearing, we heard from a representative for the Superintendents Association and the Association of School Boards, not the teachers and the support staff, but the administration, that they're seeing real impacts at the levels of principals and superintendents and CFOs and exempt employees in their retention and recruitment, and putting a lot of that towards not having a defined benefit to keep them in the system. We've heard on House Bill 55 the impacts of retention and recruitment for public safety of all types, and how not having a defined benefit allows them to leave the state after we've spent $250,000 on training a state trooper, things like that. So the goal is to stem that retention and recruitment issue. And we heard in testimony last week the need for that from both very senior teachers and educators, as well as, you know, new to the profession.
Thank you. You have a follow-up?
Yes, thank you. Follow-up. So if that's the goal, do we have data? I know we've heard from people, but has there been a comprehensive survey to determine what might actually be causing the retention?
Representative Kaufman, through the chair, yes. In May of 2001, there was a educator retention and recruitment study done by the Dunleavy administration, and there's another one currently ongoing looking at what those the reasons were. And it was the number three reason. The first two were salary and benefits, which are locally negotiated and not a statewide issue. Trying to remember the second one. It's on the slideshow that I presented on last Wednesday. But the third one was a defined benefit system. So we have done that. That was the, I wanted to say, second statewide study on educator retention. And then there's a third one going on right now, and that has continued to be one of the very top reasons.
You have a follow-up?
Yes, please. I believe you said 2001?
Yes, sir, just last year. May, I believe, of last year.
2021, I think.
What did I say?
You said 2001.
Yeah,
it was just a misspeak. Thank you.
Yeah, thank you.
When you said the Dunleavy administration.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Thank you.
Okay. Boy, that's a long term. Yeah. I don't know anybody could take that.
It would also be unconstitutional. So, yeah. Yes, I think there's
well,
a few problems there. Yeah.
It gets harder and harder. One more follow-up, please.
Go ahead.
If I may. Okay. And then additionally, the fiscal analysis of this, have you received it yet? Have I missed it, or do we have the...
Actually, I think we're the policy committee. The finance committee looks at the fiscal numbers.
But Representative Kaufman, exactly as Chair Sponholz said, we have a group putting together the funding that's going to run that actuarial study for the finance committee to make sure that the structure of it is in fact cost neutral to the state, and we would adjust those numbers in the finance dealing committee. But that is what we will be doing, and it is absolutely... the next step that we will be undertaking.
Thanks.
It does have a fiscal note, and the fiscal note in the bill is indeterminate, but if you look at what it says, the largest impact that the Department of Administration has in this fiscal note is for purchasing, hiring employees to answer the phone for the questions about if the person wants to switch from a DB to a DC. I have not had this conversation with the Department of Administration, but I understand they're coming forward with some finance fiscal notes as well in that committee.
All right. And I will, if you look back at the slides that were presented to us, prepared the teacher retention and recruitment survey results found salary were one and two. The first was cost of living as it related to where you were working. And two was the salary schedule. The retirement was number three.
Thank you.
All right. I think Representative McCarty had a question, and then we'll go to Fields next.
Okay. Thank you, Chair, and thank you for bringing this concept here. I think we have a great need to deal with that, but I have lots of questions. So one is, you already addressed the retroactive component of that, that this doesn't go back to 2006 and clean up, but really it starts when it becomes active from that point on.
Yeah.
So it's not paying people back monies for whatever, it's just recognizing that they were in 2006, if that was the case, that they were recognized back then.
On that note, Representative McCarty, through the chair, that is when the TERS 3 and PERS 4 were established and created, was in 2006. So the only people this bill would be impacting directly are employees or people who were hired from 2006 on. That's why that number is in that bill.
Do you want to follow up?
Follow up on that. So if someone did a tier four in that period of time, they could, when it becomes active, they could cash in their tier four and go to a defined benefit plan if they want to do that. Is that what would be retroactive their ability to?
Representative McCarty, more or less, yes.
Okay.
You follow up?
Another follow up is that in here I see language that seems to imply an insurance format plans, so that if someone's in a defined benefits type thing, that they pass away, that their dependents get to carry on getting benefits, which is not a normal thing for defined benefits. Once you die, that's it. You and that the defined benefit program keeps the money there. So if I, at the age of 65, let's say, and I last to 65 and a half, hoping to be 90 or whatever, but I don't make it there, that my dependents don't get the money. And at defined contributions, that is the case because you're investing. So am I reading this wrong, or is that accurate to what you're saying in this proposal?
Representative McCarty, through the chair, you are sort of reading it right. It is not an insurance policy. Currently, as you said, if a spouse passes away or who has a 401k, that individual, that spouse, the surviving dependent, gets that 401k for that person. They get both the contributions from the employer, the state, and the employee that the deceased spouse put in. They get both sides of that. We made a policy decision that we wanted to use that same structure as a 401 as the defined contribution in this bill for this idea that essentially you would also be getting the contributions your spouse made and the employer made in a defined benefit for that same system. Both sides are giving in both a contribution, DC and a DB, and we wanted to keep that similar structure. I don't know off the top of my head if it, but I believe it is the same in the defined benefit tier structures that if a dependent passes away, you do get that pension. But I would have to, Chair Sponholz says yes. So that is, we are returning to the same system that we used for many years. And as I pointed out in Wednesday's committee, two of the main drivers for the unfunded liability going through the roof was the legislature stopped funding it, and our pension obligation payments, and the health care costs. Hopefully we learned our lesson to both listen to actuaries and look at the numbers before we cancel our payments for it. And this bill does not address the healthcare costs. So the two largest drivers we've taken off the table for the bill costs.
All right. And I'm going to move next to Co-Chair Fields.
Thanks. Just adding some information in response to questions from Representative Kaufman. I think when we heard a previous iteration of this bill, for public safety, we heard from both DPS leadership and DPS employees that the lack of a defined benefit pension is the number one issue affecting trooper retention, so just another department. And then, thinking about, is this cost neutral? Obviously, the stakeholders here have done some analysis, and the previous iteration of the bill, like I mentioned, for public safety is basically the same model. So you've got multiple actuaries doing the analysis. Of course, the Finance Committee will look at it more, but I think there's a ton of due diligence that's been done where we can have a lot of confidence that it actually is cost neutral. So just wanted to reference those issues.
All right. Is there any other questions? I think Rep. McCarty might have a few more questions.
I do. Thank you. Through the chair, in section 44, you refer to certain individuals get an 8% to 10%, where other individuals' contribution is 6% to 8%. In the equitableness of state employees, why is one group getting a difference than the other? Why not make everybody 8 to 10% or vice versa?
As we took the structure of House Bill 55, which Chair Fields was referring to, that had the, for public safety, the 8 to 10 for a 20 and out or 55 years of age. Essentially, essentially, because for public employees in House Bill 220, they have a 30 years of service or 60 years of age in retirement, they're working longer. They need to put in less of their salary to reach the same amount of investment into the pension fund to get them their retirement that's calculated. You're working longer, so you're putting in more paychecks, so your percent of that paycheck can be less. For teachers in public safety, it is 8 to 10 because it's a shorter time they need to retire, so they have to put in more per paycheck to reach that shorter age. And we wanted to recognize the service that they put forward, not to say that public employees and our wildlife biologists and everybody in between do less, but for the teachers and the public safety service that they do, we wanted to recognize the opportunity to retire after slightly shorter time frame of a career.
Okay. Do you have a follow-up?
No, I'm good. Thank you.
All right. Any other questions or comments? All right. I'm sorry, Rep. Kaufman, you raised your hand before, and I Didn't look at my list.
All right. Apologize. I'm just so quiet over here.
No, I just wasn't looking at my list. I apologize.
Thank you. Through the chair to the bill sponsor. As I look at the ranking, and this is on the teacher retention recruitment survey results, competitive salary commensurate with the cost of living, and number one, enhanced salary schedule scale based on years of experience, et cetera, are the first two items. And then the third item, state goes back to a defined benefit retirement system. I assume that means that would be preferred, is the context of that. But if the top two are with respect to real-time salary, not, you know, a deferred type benefit like retirement, why the focus on this as opposed to teachers' pay?
Certainly, Representative Kaufman through the chair. There was a study funded by the legislature, I believe, in 2016. I have to make sure I added my one in there. Health Bill 296 or some high number like that. That did look at what a statewide salary schedule would look like for teachers to have them commensurate with cost of living and the district cost factors that are included. And ICER did a study based on that request from the legislature, and some of those salaries would have been double or triple what they are currently being paid in some of the more remote villages, pushing $200,000. And if the legislature wanted to put that into House Bill 220 instead of this, I'm sure they would be very appreciative. If we wanted to make $200,000 the starting educator salary, that would probably help with retention and recruitment. But it was looked at as generally unfeasible by the legislature at that time. And so that is why we did not want to start legislating statewide salary schedules, because in order to make it commensurate with hiring somebody in Queeslick or Hoona as it is in Anchorage, that would have been unfeasible and untenable.
Follow?
Mm-hmm. Yes. So, okay. So then you're thinking that this will work in lieu of $200,000. So that's a heavy lift. But and then the other thing is that in a prior discussion, you and I talked about my concern around defined benefit plans has been the failure rate, around the world or the country at least. There's so many times it's not the present day cost, it's the future obligation that's created by a system that places the state, as the future debtor, the people. And so you feel that this system is different than the ones that have failed, that have had that failure mode in the past?
Representative Kaufman through the chair. I do. My trusty staff here went through and looked for different states that have different types of structure. We are the only state in the union that does not have an option for any semblance of a defined benefit at retirement. We do not. Our educators do not have Social Security. They do not have SBS. They do not have a defined benefit here in Alaska. We are the only state in the nation that has that, or that does not have that. So some of them only have Social Security, but that is still some effort towards a defined benefit. Like I said before, the biggest reasons that our defined benefit system got out of control are not included in this bill. And so that is our biggest change in looking at trying to not put future Alaskans on the hook for unsustainable funds.
Thank you.
All right. Anybody else? Rep. Nelson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Through the chair, just off of your last comment, so you don't expect, 40 years down the road to have what we had just a decade or two ago, where we had to put $1 billion into some of the retirement systems to help try to pay off some more of that future cost. You don't expect that to happen?
Representative Nelson to the chair. No, because I hope we did learn our lesson from the actuaries. And additionally, this in the 40 years since Alaska put in the Tier 1 system, a little over 40 years, we've been through now four of them. This would be a fifth. So looking at what the nature of the time that they live in, you can adjust these systems as need be. I'm not pretending like this is going to be the last tier for the future of Alaska, but we have a problem on our hands right now that we do need to address. And the majority of PERS and TERS payments that are required by employees are for the people that have retired. Mm-hmm. It is not the cost of putting in on these current systems. And the reason that it is so strenuous on them is, we heard this in the November hearing from a national expert on pensions, we have a closed system here. A closed system means you don't have anybody else getting into that pension fund. It's putting in that money from their, both their contributions from their paychecks and the state, allowing that fund to grow while its earnings are being pulled out. We no longer have that input into the fund to help it be solvent. By putting the, by opening it back up and using that same pension fund with these new employees, it will help make that more solvent and not have the problem that we're having over the last 20 years or so, 15, I guess. And also, I hope we learned our lesson about shady actuaries.
Paula?
No, I'm good. Thank you.
Yeah, and I think that there are a few provisions of this bill that prevent us from running into the same situation that we ran into in the past with obligations that were beyond what we could afford. And some of that was in part due to bad actuarial analysis at that time. But part of it was about structure, and we've changed the structure in this bill, I think, in a way that ensures that if somebody's pension is underfunded for some reason, then their obligation to pay increases moving forward. And I appreciate the work that you've done to make sure that this is structurally sound. We definitely don't want to put the state on the hook for a retirement program that we can't afford, but we definitely have a system that isn't working for our state, and it's been identified both public safety and public educators as a huge problem. We're hemorrhaging public safety and public educators in the state of Alaska in a way that's really dangerous. We have also seen that we're beginning to hemorrhage public employees in other sectors of the state. And we've heard in recent, some of the finance subcommittee hearings, there are some departments that have as high of divisions with as high as a 20% vacancy rate. We heard in the Department of Revenue recently that the Treasury has a 20% vacancy rate right now. And we need to do everything that we can to ensure that we can continue to retain, attract and retain high quality employees, because these services are important to the people of Alaska. So I really appreciate the work that you've done on this. All right. Did you want to make a comment?
One more question.
Go ahead.
All right. Through the chair, another question. And I greatly appreciate what you're doing with this. And like the chair said, that our teachers have got the short end of the stick over the many years and not even getting the benefits of Social Security. In this, you make mention of if there's some type of disability or death due to any circumstance, on the job or not on the job, that they get benefits to that. And I'm wondering, like, if I'm, say, a teacher, and I like to go bungee jumping, but I don't like to spend a lot of money on cords, so I'll just go for it with one cord, and I get hurt, It's not on the job, but where is it that this becomes like an insurance, life insurance, health insurance, whatever? Where's the responsibility of the person compared to it being on the job? Do you understand what I'm asking?
I believe so, Representative McCarty, through the chair. First of all, I certainly want to go bungee jumping. That is one of my life goals, went skydiving, next is bungee jumping. But on that note, the responsibility for the employer or the employee would be to maintain their job, to maintain their employment so that they can keep the fund solvent for how long they work there. They won't get 30 years of credit if they've only worked 15 years. So what they and that spouse who is still left alive wouldn't be overdrawing from the fund that for work that employee did not do. So it's not like they're getting time. It's not like they're getting credit for time they didn't serve. It would still be a solvent fund for the amount of time that they have put in. So again, it was a policy decision by us as the bill sponsor to make sure that you get what you have worked for, and that was our decision putting it in there. I don't see it as life insurance. I see it as retirement, and if an unfortunate accident does happen, whether it's driving to work or walking to work, you want to make sure that you don't lose what you have put in already. And having put in a decent portion of your salary, up to 10% max of your salary every paycheck. Just because an accident happens doesn't mean that should be swept away and your family doesn't receive any benefit for the work you have done and the contributions you have made.
Just one more.
Last follow-up, So thank
you. We're past the amendment deadline. I'm indulging folks a little bit here, but we may need to Move along.
Thank you. So, well, I'll just stop there. That's fine. Thanks.
All right. Thanks. All right. Is there a motion?
Thanks. Sheriff Sponholz, I move House Bill 220, Work Order 32-LS0717-A from committee.
Is there any objection? All right. Seeing none, HB 220 moves from committee. We're going to take a brief at ease and sign the paperwork. Ground. All right, and now we're at next up to another hearing and public testimony in House Bill 159, the Consumer Data Privacy Act. I think Rep. Fields had a comment that he wanted to make.
Thanks. I'd hope that we could have amendments ready to consider tonight, but just given that it's kind of a technical bill, I'm still working with some stakeholders on amendments to make sure that we don't unintentionally regulate businesses that aren't even involved in buying and selling people's data. So we're just working on refining who's encompassed in the scope of this bill, and hope to have those ready by Friday, but obviously it's more important to get it right than to rush it, so we're working on that language now.
All right, Brett Coffin.
I just want to say thank you to that. My core objection to this right now is that it's complicated, and we've been struggling with it, hence hearing it so many times, which right. I respect. If we're going to do something, let's do it right. Thank you.
All right. Thanks. All right. Any other questions or comments before we move into testimony? All right. We're going to go ahead and open up public testimony now. All right. First up, we're going to go to Robert Woody in Florida.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. Can you hear me?
I can hear you just fine.
Great. I am Robert Woody, and I'm pleased to testify today on behalf of a coalition of insurance trade associations, the American Property Casualty Insurers Association, or APCIA, for which I work, as well as two other associations, the National Association of Mutual Insurance Companies, or NAMIC, and the American Council of Life Insurers. We've submitted a written letter to the committee outlining our thoughts on HB 159, but I just wanted to take just a few minutes to highlight our most important points for you briefly now. Our coalition appreciates the intention of the bill sponsor in including an exemption for personal information that is subject to Title V of the Federal Gramm-Leach-Bliley Act, or GLBA. Now, the purpose of this bill is to provide Alaskans with the ability to know what information companies collect and to provide some control over how data is used. But it is appropriate to recognize that insurance consumers are already protected by the very strict privacy and regulatory regime that Gramm-Leach-Bliley prescribes. As you may know, Gramm-Leach-Bliley is enforced against insurers by state insurance regulators, including Commissioner Wing-Hyer in Alaska. And in addition to protecting consumer privacy, Alaska's insurance regulation requires insurers to have a comprehensive written plan to protect the security and confidentiality of data against threats and unauthorized access. Now, Gramm-Leach-Bliley was enacted over 20 years ago, and state insurance privacy laws and regulations implementing it have been enforced for nearly that long. Those regulations work well, and more importantly, they protect consumers in such a way that it's easy for them to understand what insurers do and don't do with their data and what their rights are. But while that intent is good, we have found that a better and more effective approach is to cast this as an entity-level Gramm-Leach-Bliley exemption rather than a data-level exemption. In other words, exempting all entities that are subject to Gramm-Leach-Bliley rather than just specific data. After all, the goal of the exemption here is to ensure that insurers and their consumers are not subject to a patchwork of state and federal laws in the privacy area. And the reason that's a goal is because a patchwork of rules is difficult for consumers to understand and for businesses to accommodate. It makes much more sense for any given entity and its consumers to be subject to a single set of privacy rules. That prevents complications and confusion for consumers that may arise as definitions of personal information can change over time in state laws. Now, Virginia and Colorado have both adopted entity-level GLBA exemptions, and they now have widespread industry support, while also helping make it easier for consumers to understand the strong privacy rules that protect their data. Both those states' new privacy laws do regulate other industries that have not been previously regulated for privacy. So this bill could do that for Alaska insurance consumers as well with the proper wording. The letter that we submitted offers a suggested improvement on the exemption wording, and we hope you will consider that suggestion carefully. And indeed, I had a very productive conversation earlier today with Representative Fields and his staff, and reiterated our willingness to work with you on that. And just finally, very quickly, I also do want to point out that if we were subject to this bill, we do have some other concerns about it. The biggest one is the private right of action. And I'll only speak to the impact of a private right of action on insurers. But the Alaska Division of Insurance has a variety of tools at its disposal to enforce the existing insurance privacy and data security laws and regulations. A private right of action, we think, would undermine the division's authority and result in disparate outcomes for insurance consumers. But we don't think that's the intent of the bill, so again, our suggested language would resolve that issue, at least for us, and we're happy to work with Representative Fields and others on the committee on that. The goal should be that the Division of Insurance retains its undiluted enforcement authority over insurance consumer privacy. So I'll stop there and thank you again for the opportunity to testify, and I'd be happy to answer any questions that any committee members might have.
All right. Thank you very much for your testimony. Are there any questions for the testifier? All right. Thank you very much. Next up, we're going to go to Maya McKenzie in Alabama.
Good afternoon, Senator Sponholz and members of the committee. My name is Maya McKenzie, and I'm Technology Policy Counsel for the Entertainment Software Association, which is the Video Game Industry's Trade Association. Thank you for the opportunity to testify today. Our industry has long supported efforts and complied with laws that keep children safe online and provide parents and guardians with transparency and choice about how their children's data is collected and used. State privacy legislation should not conflict with existing children's privacy laws. And so for this reason, we testify as neutral to House Bill 159, but support three additional amendments to this bill. First, this bill should clarify that a business should not process data from a consumer under 13 unless it's processed as provided by COPPA. Now, COPPA is a longstanding children's privacy law around which our members have designed robust compliance programs. Second, this bill deviates from the COPPA actual knowledge standard for determining age. We support an amendment to strike section 45.48.845B, which states a business that recklessly disregards the likelihood that a consumer is under 18 is considered to have actual knowledge. This bill incorporates sufficient protection for minors by requiring parental consent for minors under 13 and opt-in consent for minors 13 to 17. Including this instructive knowledge standard muddies the waters on the legal standard and unnecessarily creates liability for businesses which seek to protect consumers. Finally, we support an amendment to clarify that parental consents obtained as provided by COPPA are sufficient consents under this bill. COPPA's verifiable parental consent standards have been fine-tuned through the law and subsequent regulation to ensure that a workable standard is in place for containing obtaining parental consent. This amendment would ensure existing practices did not run afoul of state law. We appreciate the sponsor's thoughtful approach to consumer privacy and children's privacy specifically, excuse me, and look forward to continued collaboration on a bill that aligns with existing children's privacy laws. I'm happy to answer any questions, and again, thank you for your time.
All right, thank you. Are there any questions for the testifier? All right, Rep. McCarty.
Through the chair, you asked, you suggested a certain section be struck. What is that section again?
Hi, this is Maya. Can I just hop in right here?
Go ahead.
It's section 45.48.845B.
Thank you.
All right. Any other questions? All right. Thank you very much for your testimony, Ms. McKenzie. Next up, we're going to go to Anton Van Seventer in Washington, D.C.
Thank you. And thank you to the chair for the opportunity to testify today. My name is Anton, and I am testifying as counsel of the State Privacy and Security Coalition.
What's your last name?
Well-intentioned. Van Seventer.
Great. Thank you.
Thank you. Although the bill is well-intentioned, at a high level, it does include a host of outlier requirements that are found in no other state
and
law.
Did you
as well
say
as several provisions that could simply lead to widespread confusion? So first, the bill includes a requirement for businesses to comply with a global privacy control, which creates technical impracticalities and would actually undermine consumer choice. It is technically unfeasible because if selected, the signal system selects with the choices consumers make on a business's website page itself is also required in the law. These include any opt-ins as well as the context of consumer trust, where a consumer does not actually wish to opt out once they access the site, but is painted into a corner by the broad brush of the browser signal. Furthermore, I don't think the global privacy control truly effectuates the aims of this bill that I'm seeing. If selected, it would prevent consumers from actively choosing to permit certain sites to collect or disclose information while opting out of sale by others. Consumers would actually have to opt back in by disabling the signal whenever they wanted to grant permission even to a single site, which in turn would then permit other sites to resume selling or disclosing consumer data. This is true even if the consumer would have locally opted out of all but one of these sites. Second, the bill does include an underlying private right of action via the reference to the state UDAP statute, which studies and recent experience have shown becomes a tool to harass businesses rather than benefit consumers, really regardless of the underlying provision. Even without a violation, the provision practically guarantees that nuisance litigants will seize the opportunity to inflict asymmetrical e-discovery costs on businesses, with the cost to defend these non-meritorious actions historically averaging $500,000 for Alaska companies. Studies have similarly revealed that private rights of action fail to compensate consumers even when a violation has been shown and instead primarily benefit the plaintiff. For these reasons, no state, including even California, at least for privacy violations, has chosen to go down this path. Unlike the broader class action that would be present in this bill via the UDAP statute, the private right of action in California was restricted to data breaches, and this still brought a raft of frivolous lawsuits and significant unintended consequences. Finally, the bill mostly includes the vague and often overbroad definitions from the CCPA. We strongly recommend the clarified and updated language written into the Virginia and Colorado laws after observing the confusion created in California for the business community and consumer advocates alike. Thank you again, and I'm open to any questions you may have. Thank you.
All right. Are there any questions for Mr. Van Seventer? All right. There are no questions for you. Thank you very much for your time today. Next up, we're going to go to Alyssa Doom in Washington, D.C.
Great. Can everyone hear me?
We can hear you loud and clear. Go ahead and introduce yourself, including any affiliation you have for the record, and proceed with your testimony.
Great. Thank you. Alyssa Doom with the Computer and Communications Industry Association. Good evening, Chair Sponholz, Chair Fields, and members of the committee. Thank you again for this opportunity to provide testimony on HB 159. As I said, I'm Alyssa Doom, and I'm speaking today on behalf of the Computer and Communications Industry Association, or CCIA. CCIA is a nonprofit, nonpartisan trade association representing a broad cross-section of small, medium, and large communications and technology firms. We support a uniform federal approach to privacy protections to ensure that consumers are able to understand and exercise their rights, and that companies, particularly small and medium-sized businesses, have regulatory certainty in meeting compliance obligations. So while we appreciate the sponsor's efforts to protect the privacy rights of Alaskans and the tremendous work that's gone into drafting and workshopping this bill, we do still have concerns over the adoption of jurisdiction-specific legislation that would just add to the existing patchwork of state privacy laws. And at this time, we do respectfully ask that you oppose HB 159. I've also submitted written comments sharing some of CCIA's concerns with the bill. And should members of the committee have any questions for me, I've included my contact information in those comments, and I'm happy to connect to answer any questions that you might have following the hearing. Thank you again for the committee's time.
All right. Are there any questions for Ms. Doom? All right. There are no questions for you. Thank you very much for your testimony today. Next up, we're going to go to David Edmondson in Austin, Texas.
Good evening, Chair Sponholz, Chair Fields, and members of the committee. My name is David Edmondson. I am TechNet's VP of State Policy and Government Relations. I am here testifying in respectful opposition to HB 159. The technology industry is fully committed to securing privacy and security for consumers and engages in a wide range of practices to provide consumers with notice, choices about how their data is used, as well as control over their data. TechNet supports a federal standard that establishes a uniform set of rights and responsibilities for all Americans. The borderless nature of the internet demands a federal policy, and even the most well-designed state statute will ultimately contribute to a patchwork of different standards across the country, resulting in a steep compliance cost and consumer confusion. In the absence of a federal standard, TechNet urges states debating their own legislation to consider interoperability with existing models as the default position. Specifically, states should look to the most recent examples of Virginia and Colorado, which present a clearer, more explicit explanation of consumer rights and controller responsibilities. Instead, HB 159 looks to the California model, which remains a moving target. California businesses and consumers currently live under a privacy regime that was enacted in 2018, interpreted through a long series of rulemakings by the AG's office. But that regime will be supplanted in 2023 by a new authority, the California Privacy Protection Agency, which is tasked with enforcing a 2020 law, which is the subject of a current series of rulemakings by the new agency. Additionally, and similar to what others have raised, we have concerns with enforcement being conducted via private right of action. Under a PRA, any unintentional or perceived violation could result in enormous liability for companies. The penalties imposed under this bill would enable class action firms to wield this statute as a cudgel against well-meaning businesses to extract significant settlements from companies with little or no actual value delivered to the consumer. Because managing personal data and data subject rights requests are operationally very complicated, accidental and good faith mistakes, like unintentionally omitting a category of data received by a third party, can be common. Central enforcement by an attorney general with a right to cure period ensures that justice is meted out evenly and that enforcement actions are targeted at those causing actual harm to Alaskans, not just those that offer opportunity for a lucrative settlement. Thank you for your time.
All right. Thank you very much for your testimony. Are there any questions for Mr. Edmondson? All right. Seeing none. Thank you very much for your testimony today. All right, and that is going to conclude our public testimony today. I'm going to go ahead and close public testimony at this point in time. There is nobody in the room. Welcome back, Representative Prox. I think you joined us earlier at 5:51 for a little while. Glad to hear of your interest in the consumer data privacy legislation. So that wraps up our business for this evening. We got done a little bit earlier than we'd intended. I want to thank everybody for joining us today. We're going to meet again on Friday. We're going to meet at two different times on Friday. We're going to meet at 9 a.m. and we're going to take up 159 final action at that point in time. And then on Friday afternoon at 3:15 at our regular time, Friday, January 28th, we're going to have some presentation on the Economic and Investment Jobs Act. So the infrastructure and Infrastructure Investment and Jobs Act, so we can properly sort of start to wrap our hands around what that's going to mean for the state of Alaska, so we can make sure that we're properly responding as a legislature in support of our state's efforts to take advantage of that, those jobs and the work that's available to us. Thanks again to our Secretary Leah Fraser and our LAO moderator Nate Williams for your time, and congratulations to Chelsea on her first bill movement out of committee today. This meeting of the House Labor and Commerce Committee is adjourned at 6:06 p.m.